Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for rating, subscribing, and sharing. If you haven't done it, I know that you will do it. Please make sure that you share this episode through email and most especially through word of mouth. Make sure that you are doing what you can to get this information out there. And I truly appreciate all of your efforts so far. Remember, you can follow the page at Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook. You can support the podcast through Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon. Also, you can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo. All of those are CPTL Hunter. Lawrence Hunter, CPTL Hunter. That's through PayPal. Today's episode, we got a good one for you. I have an attorney from the Philippines, Ms. Christine Mendoza. She works for Street Law PH that's down there in the Philippines. She's going to talk to us about the war on drugs that's going on and has ravaged the country down in the Philippines. When you hear her story, when you hear what's going on down there in the Philippines concerning the war on drugs, you will be shocked. So make sure that you are seated in, strapped in, as she's going to discuss what's going on down there in the Philippines. I hope that she and her cohorts are staying safe and doing what they have to do in order to stay safe. I met Ms. Mendoza at the Drug Reform Conference in St. Louis, Missouri. She was so kind enough to, from the Philippines, come to the Drug Reform Conference in St. Louis, Missouri. Then she swung over to New York for a little while, took in some sites and everything like that. And while she was there, she gave me a call and we got this interview done. So I really, really appreciate her taking the time and taking the effort. And truth be told, I had some technical difficulties and she was so patient and so kind to do the interview. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with attorney at law, Ms. Christine Mendoza, all the way from the Philippines, but she's in New York as we record this. Here we go. Thank you for being on Captain Hunter's Podcast. I'm on with Christine M. Mendoza, advocacy and legal officer. You have an organization that you're going to tell us about, and you are fighting for justice. We met at a conference in St. Louis, a drug reform conference, and the talk that you gave was very interesting, so I wanted to have you on the podcast. So thank you again for being on the podcast. If you would, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm Christine Mendoza. My organization is called Street Law Philippines. It's an organization of lawyers who provide access to justice services to people who use drugs in the Philippines. So we just started. We started in 2017, and we provide legal literacy trainings, paralegal trainings to people who use drugs in the Philippines. We also do harm reduction. And we also do advocacy and policy reforms. So that's kind of the profile of our organization.
Very nice. And how did you get into this line of work?
It started in this program in the University of Hong Kong, Drug Policy and Human Rights. It was in 2016. At the time, there have already been 4,000 deaths of Filipino who use drugs. And we want to understand what's happening in the country. It took us by surprise. It was shock and awe in 2016. So we were in this program. There are a lot of lawyers in that program and decided to, you know, come together and realize that there's no human rights organizations fighting for the rights of people who use drugs in the Philippines. There are other for other marginalized sectors, the women, LGBT, IP, farmers, labor, but none for people who use drugs. Also, at that time, that was the only time that we saw a special marginalized sector, the criminalized sector, that we're not able to provide services for. And that's kind of concerning, alarming at that point, because even at 4,000 deaths in 2016, people don't really care about it. It's kind of legitimized in the eyes of the public. And that's what worried us and made us realize that we have to do something about this. This can't go on. These are killings. These are human rights violations. That's this war on drugs gave birth to our organization.
So a lot of times I would always think about the war on drugs being a situation that was only occurring in the United States. It's mm-hmm. interesting to know that it's going on in the Philippines. And this started in 2016 with the election of Duterte. Am I saying his name right?
Duterte. It's like all the colonial policies that were got from our colonial masters. It's one of them. The war on drugs began in the Philippines in 2016. I mean, at least formally, in a very intense way. We have prohibitionist policies when it comes to drugs. Our drug laws have been there since, you know, it's been a crime since the beginning. We have a new comprehensive dangerous drugs law, which actually is just about the crimes, the prohibited acts, and the imprisonment. So even for drug use, you get to be arrested for drug use, and then you go to a mandatory facility-based rehab as your penalty. And if you relapse, you're going to go to jail. So that has been our drug policy. And when Duterte came into power, he kind of ramps that up, make it more intense, definitely more violent. And he, what's peculiar in the campaign that he launched in 2016 was to enjoin the community police, the Philippine National Police, to go after low-level drug offenders, drug users, those who possess for personal use, those who sell for a small amount of grams, for a small amount of money. So before Duterte, the policy was, of course, all of them are treated in our laws, technically as criminals. But the focus was on the high-value drug traffickers. So the police operations are conducted by the Philippine Drug Enforcement Agency. That's the DEA, I think, in the U.S. counterpart. So they're more concerned with drug traffickers. So they are in the ports. They are in the airport terminals, all those. They want to intercept the drug traffickers, the smugglers. So they're there. What's new in 2016 is now the police are in the communities. They are in the neighborhoods, and they're going after low-level offenders. This is their demand reduction kind of strategy. And it's been causing a lot of problems and a lot of human rights violations in the country. And yeah, it's the war on drugs in the same way. It's in the U.S., it's anti the blacks and the marginalized, the people of color. In the Philippines, it's anti-poor. So those who are in the poorer communities are targeted. And the way they legitimize it is that this is a war on drugs. And those who use drugs, most especially the meth users, are in the poorer communities. So, well, it's in the U.S., I think it's a question of racial justice. In the Philippines, it's the rights of the people who are poor.
Now, what is the drugs of choice in the Philippines?
So we have three. Of course, that's not just three, but most of the drug users in the Philippines, they use cannabis, meth. It's in other parts of the world, but they have this glue thing that they sniff and solvent. Of course, in some other middle-class communities, most of them use ecstasy. Yes, cannabis also. Ecstasy, cannabis, other party drugs, MDMA. Those are available in the Philippines. But most of the drug users, the significant number of them, meth, cannabis, and solvents.
It's interesting that you talked about the war on drugs in the United States being a war on people of color, for lack of a better term. So is it recognized in the Philippines that, you know, the United States is attacking black people, attacking brown people? Is that recognized?
No. That's what's lacking in the way this whole thing is communicated to the public. It lacks that kind of, you know, race lens. Oh, it's not perceived in, it's not analyzed or seen in the racial justice perspective. There's no social justice lens used when it comes to, you know, talking about how the war on drugs is actually waged against people of color. It's just about drug users. So it's legitimized in that way because they use drugs, because they sell drugs, because they are profiting from doing drug offenses. And that stops there. The narrative stops there. They forget that these people are people of color, that they forget that these people are poor, they're homeless, they don't have choices in life. And that's what's missing in a drug war that we get to hear on our side of the world. It's just, you know, it's as if it's just a legitimate police operations and the number of drugs seized and the people arrested for that.
Now, in the minds of the people in the Philippines, right, this war is working, right? It's it's reducing crime. It's doing all the,
I mean, unfortunately, that they think that it's working.
It's unfortunate that it's working. Yeah. So it's in the minds of the middle to upper class people, right? The homicides are down, the burglaries are down, the larcenies are down. So it's hard to disagree with what the president is doing or is trying to do, right?
Yes, there was a recent survey which said that 82% of Filipinos approve the war on drugs.
Wow, that's a high number.
That's 82% have not had anything on anything. Well, we don't have that kind of consensus on matters. And that's
right,
It's really telling of the way the police and the government was able to be at the forefront of the narrative making in this kind of scene. I mean, in the campaign, they were able to have communication strategies that are effective. So at the start, they said that, oh, we're going to have drug-free Philippines by 2022. And these are our strategies. These are the metrics by way we will measure success. Number of arrests, number of people in prison, number of people who surrendered, number of people we put in community-based rehab, whatever that means. But at the onset, they were able to say that these are the metrics. After 3 years, they said that, okay, so we were able to get the numbers and we were able to reduce crime. And that's the main objective, reduce crime. But this is not just about the numbers. They tend to forget the number of people killed, the number of people in prison, women in prison. It's 100% increase in some of the female dormitories, all for drug offenses. And the number of students who have to undergo drug testing, urine testing. So it's kind of blind. The metrics are blind to the real impact of the War on Drugs campaign. And that's the main thing. That's the main narrative that they're selling. It reduces crime. But as you said, it's just crime against property. The middle class and the upper class are concerned about crimes against property because they have property. So less burglary, less theft, less robbery, less, you know, murder committed by what they call poor people. So it's good for them. So they remain supportive of this war because it benefits them. To them, it's making the streets safer because they don't see drug users using drugs in the streets and they can come home late at night without fearing, being robbed or being asked for money. I don't know. To them, it's their only concern and it's very selfish and it is not very conscious of the fact that this is a class war. It's divide and conquer. That's a strategy. You divide people according to their interests because they're self-interested anyway. So they cater to the middle class and the upper class, those people who are in power, those people who pay taxes, of course, because they can't pay taxes. And they kind of legitimized this whole campaign, saying that it's actually working, it's actually effective. See, we have better lives, and forget it's convenient, because it's convenient for them to forget the lives of other people, those in the poorer communities, those who were killed. And so even the number of deaths, 35,000 or so, 5,000 killed according to the police, but now it's at 7,000 according to the academe, that were killed in police operations, they tend to forget that. They set that aside and say that, well, it's an effective strategy. We don't care. So that's how they were able to make this a very popular campaign. And that makes Duterte some kind of have this kind of social control and political control over the Filipinos. And it's being imported by Duterte in some other places in the world, and Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Indonesia is actually looking at Duterte and saying that, well, what he's doing is effective. Maybe we should do some sort of copy that kind of policy. And I don't know. I don't get it, actually. It's something that is very alarming. And in the way that we are at this point in time globally, where the conservatives are in power, those who are fascist are in power, it's scary that we have this kind of campaigns, and that we were able to have this populist leaders and have this campaign against the poor, against the marginalized, against the people of color to be legitimate. That's what's concerning.
It would seem as if, though, those people in the higher classes are saying or turning a blind eye to the people who are dying because they're almost a throwaway population, right? These are 35,000 or 7,000 people who are drug users anyway, so who's going to miss them? That's essentially what they're saying.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. The stigma is really something that's deeply seated in the minds of the people, and it's the stigma of drug use and those who are dealing with drugs, and the stigma of being poor and homeless and jobless. It's that's what make their lives, according to these people, dispensable. It's like dispensable, something that you can, you know, just throw away because they don't contribute to society anyway. Their problems, their eyesores. So it's kind of we're joking about this, that it's an anti-poverty program. The anti-poverty program of Duterte is to kill the poor. And the war on drugs is a way for him to legitimize it.
Wow, that's really deep, really deep. Can you talk about when we were at the conference, they were talking about a term that was very new to me, and that's harm reduction. Harm reduction versus the abstinence programs. Talk about the comparison between those two.
So harm reduction is not really, we call this... it's not very abstinence versus harm reduction way. It's abstinence is actually part of harm reduction. It's harm reduction, as we said, it's meeting people where they're at. It's a policy, programs, even say that it's a philosophy of people keeping safe. People who use drugs don't need treatment anyway. I mean, 10% of drug users are the only ones that has, I wouldn't say it problematic, but it's the way 10% of people who use drugs need some kind of sort of intervention. And that's where the treatment centers come in. That's where the programs, rehab programs come in. And some of them uses abstinence-based approach. And well, according to evidence accumulated over the years, it's not abstinence-based approach. It's not really very effective if you want to address drug dependence. So harm reduction is that gamut of services, a continuum of services that you offer to people who use drugs, meeting them where they're at, letting them set their own goals. So if they want to stop drug use, okay, so we can, you know, help them go into that direction, maybe manage it first once a week, twice a week, small doses. If do you wanna, if you're on some other drugs that has substitution, there's substitution therapy treatment. So some have methadone that are available. So mostly heroin users, they use methadone. So it's they go to centers, they're given that kind of substitute to drug use, and it's effective. They were able to address their dependence on heroin in some of these centers. Others, they have, it depends on which drug you use. So for heroin users, there's substitution therapy. For those who are injecting drugs, they use needle syringe programs. So they will not transmit blood-related diseases via sharing of syringes. So yeah, heroin users, those who inject drugs like opioids in the Philippines, in the brain, they're given free new needles. Some of them, they even in the outreach programs, they crush the used needles so somebody else won't use them anymore because it would make them vulnerable to HIV, Hep C, and other blood-related diseases. So for meth users, it's called trip sitting. Well, that's what we have right now in the Philippines. That's what we're teaching the community-based rehab programs because we don't have a lot of resources and the studies on meth are not yet that much compared to other drug use, other drugs. So those who are high, they come into the centers, to the community-based programs, and then someone is supposed to look after them while they crash, while they do with their withdrawals. Someone is going to keep them safe in case they want to take again some drugs. Even in some other countries, they have drug consumption rooms. I know you've heard of them. It's a safe place for people to shoot drugs, people to take drugs. There's going to be a nurse. There's going to be a doctor who's going to
take it. That seems so wild to me. Really does.
I have seen some of them in Copenhagen, in Denmark, and their goal, really. It depends on the goal, actually. It depends on what you want to achieve. So in that area, in that part of Copenhagen, they wanted to prevent overdose. And these drug consumption rooms, they're actually preventing overdoses because people are coming in, drug users are coming in, and they are watched over by nurses, health professionals, so they won't overdose. Of course, they're linked to other services. It's not just health. It's also social services. So if they use drugs to keep them warm at night, because most of them are homeless and they're in countries where there's winter, they give them halfway houses, they give them coats, they give them a hot coffee while they're on the streets. Some of them don't have jobs, so they, you know, link them up to some employment opportunities. Most in my country, that's also the problem with meth. We're always saying this, that you manage the use, but you also address the root cause. Maybe you use meth, so you have to stay awake because you have a 24/7 job and you have other side hustles and you need that much money to send your kids to school. So maybe we can link you up to some employment opportunities that will make you, allow you to sleep, or, you know, at least make both ends meet without, you know, having some sort of, need to take drugs. And those are kind of very individualized services, programs that cater to people who use drugs, help them address their drug use. We're not saying that they should take drugs, that drugs are not harmful. Drugs are harmful. People who have not yet done drugs should not do so. So, but if they're already there and they need help, they're already dependent. They already have problems with the way they have problems and everything with the way they use drugs. We can't just leave them alone. We have to meet them where they're at. We have to help them and whatever goal they wanna achieve in their lives. It's sort of very practical. That's what I call right harm reduction. It's very practical. It's very reasonable. It's something that works. And people should, you know, most of the mainstream programs are abstinence-based. And most drug users, when they come in, they say that, oh, we want to actually stop doing drugs. And okay, that's okay. If you can do abstinence and that is your goal, it's okay. But if you relapse, we won't kick you out of the program because relapse is part of treatment. Relapse is part of the, you know, it's the part of the process. So, and most abstinence-based programs, and I'm very critical of them, would deny other people of the services once they relapse. And that's the problem. You don't do that. It's not very evidence-based. It's not helping people reach their goal. It's very punitive. And it should, well, they're not treatment health services. That's good. That's great. And I love people doing that for people who use drugs, but we have to rethink our ways, be more practical, be more humane, compassionate in the way we provide services. And that's harm reduction.
Very nice. So, and along the terms of this harm reduction and understanding and being more practical and more humane, in a previous conversation we had, we talked about how the poorer people were using the meth and how, and they were using it because they were trying to stay awake or stay alert on their jobs for longer periods of time, right? So they work 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever they're working. And because it doesn't pay enough, those jobs don't pay enough, so they had to do extra work. And so in order to be alert and to be active and vibrant, they were taking this meth.
Yes, yes. That's a situation in the Philippines. And that's what's left out of the narrative. These people that are targeted by these operations, top three of those who were killed were in the public transportation. We call it pedicab. It's the pedicab drivers and the taxi drivers and I think jeepney drivers or farmers. Those who are in the top 10 professions or work or job, actually it's in informal sector, those are hardworking people. They have 24/7 jobs or more than 24/7 jobs because they're not regularized. When you're regularized or you're in the formal sector, you get to have benefits. You get to have 8 hour limit of work per day. But if you have a big family, you have kids to send to school, you have somebody who needs medical attention in the family and you don't have health insurance, you need more jobs. And that's the social aspect of this war or this or the way the people perceive drug use in the at least in the Philippines. There was a study by a community-based program amongst people who use drugs, and they asked them, why do you use drugs? And it's basically to function. So most of those targeted by the war, they use drugs. They're functional users. They're not recreational users. Some of the drug users in the Philippines are recreational users, but those who are targeted, most especially those who are using meth, they're functional users at the start of their at the history of their drug use, because yes, they come from lower income families. They are come from communities doing informal sector, construction workers, taxi drivers. They needed more money, they needed more hours to work, and they needed meth to do that. And I don't know why people don't see that in that way, that they're actually victims of this sort of economic structure that exploits them, that makes them suffer this working condition, so just so they can have enough money, just so they can live, so just so their families could live.
That's really a terrible thing. Of course, that isn't just hitting the Philippines. It's obviously hitting the United States, where people are working longer and harder for less pay or for the same amount of pay and not getting advancements, right? Not having health care and having all the social issues that you were just talking about. Really terrible. Before, we talked about the statistics about the harm that is being done by these police raids, police operations. You said 35,000 people have been killed since this war. 7,000 of them have been right. attributed to the death of by police officers.
Yes.
So obviously there's a ramping up of police operations, and that's hurting people. It's killing people. More people are in jail, which has got to be a bigger expense by the government to house all these people yes. and put them in jail, right?
Yes. They have, our jails are already congested even before this war started. I'm not yet sure if my numbers are correct, but I think that we are at 400% capacity. So,
wow.
So that's wow. so many. And most of them are, it became a problem, most especially after 2016 and this war started, that the judiciary, in the criminal justice system, those in the judicial system recognize it already as a problem, and they now are giving plea bargaining deals for people in jail for drug use or for drug offenses, so they can now admit to a lesser offense and they go out to community-based programs. That's because the judiciary, those who are in the justice sector, they realize that you can't keep that much people in jail, and you can't feed them, you can't, you know, use public funds for these people. So it's just better to send them out. The problem is, if you send them out, most of them wanted to stay in the prisons, because now outside they're going to be targets of the police, and that's going to be a problem also. So it's that kind of, you know, damn if you do, damn if you don't. So it really is creating problems on so many fronts. And it's a good thing that the judiciary has come around and allowed plea bargaining deals. And yes, they are now being released to community-based rehab programs, even the drug sellers, which doesn't make sense. But now that they have this kind of out-of-prison program, and because of the overflowing population in the prisons, we have to now address the problems. And that once they're out, what's in it for them? Are you going to give them a reintegration program? Are you going to give them jobs after the community-based rehab? Or you're just going to get them back in the watch list, in the police list, and get them killed? So,
jeez. Oh,
that's the... yes. Wow. Yeah, some drug users. There was this father who asked the court to just jail his son. It was like a voluntary thing because his son was using, and he doesn't want him to be in the watch list of the police. So he doesn't want his son to be killed. So he's asking the court, can you just please take my son inside the prison? So at least, you know, well, it's not going to be 100% safe there, but he's getting assurance that it's not going to be shot in their homes. So that happened. And that was telling of the problem that we are facing, this whole mess that we're in right now.
Does the Philippines have a Bill of Rights, or, and I don't know, you have to educate me, do they have a Bill of Rights or constitution that guarantees the rights for people? Do they have anything like that?
Yes, because being a colony of the United States for 50 years and almost 50 years, and then we had a Commonwealth government. So our forms of government, our political system is copied from the US. So we're not federal because we're just small, but we have a presidential type of system. We have a constitution. The amendments that you have, except for the right to bear arms, we have that as our Bill of Rights.
So, listen, you don't want that.
So we delete that. We don't just copied everything. So most of our laws are copied from the United States. So we have Bill of Rights. We have the rights of the accused. We have Miranda rights. So once you get arrested, the police has to recite all the rights that you have, the right to remain silent, your right to a lawyer. Everything is the way the U.S., I think, the implementation is totally a different story. But We have that.
Okay.
And then we have even the rights of the accused are in a law. So we have the rights of the accused while in their detention, custodial investigation, while subjected to arrest. We need a warrant for arrest, a warrant for searches. Otherwise, all the evidence that you don't have jurisdiction over the person, and all the things that you seized in the person's home will not be used as evidence. All those rights. We even have graft court for public officers who does graft and corruption. We have an ombudsman. It's a prosecution for public officials. So police can be prosecuted, investigated by the ombudsman. And we also have a commission on human rights, where human rights violations can be investigated, documented. So we all have that sort of robust system for accountability, mostly copied from the United States and the protecting the rights of the accused and those protecting them from human rights violations committed by state forces.
Well, very nice. I received an education just now. Who is it that you all are appealing to, your organization? Obviously, you're trying to get people off of drugs or do the harm reduction as to them, but you're advocating for some type of changes within the police forces. Is that right? Who is it that you're advocating to? For the police to change? For your lawyers? For the legislatures, your governors to change? Who is it that you're actually trying to get your message out to? Even the people, right? Because 82% of them, you said, are in favor of the drug war. Whose minds are you trying to change?
Well, first are policymakers. It's not just the police, because the police they're trained to... They're civilian in nature, and they should be under a National Police Commission, which is a civilian... It's only one out of four commissioners that are from the securities, that is from the security sector. So they are a civilian commission, but they are part of this commission that controls the police, that supervises the police. It's part of the larger, group of policymakers in the Philippines that we want to target. We want to advocate for drug policy reform. We wanted those who are in the legislature, in the judicial system, in the legal system, in the security sector reform, those in the higher ups, to realize that we're doing drug policing wrong. We're targeting the marginalized. We're just killing poor people. And that's not how you fight drugs. And we should change our drug laws. We should, if we can't decriminalize drug use and those who are possessing for drug use, we kind of, depenalize them and put them in jail, put them in some sort of harm reduction service or some community-based program that's going to help them. That's health-based approach. Focus your attention to those drug traffickers. Don't do drug operations in the neighborhoods, in the communities. That's very violent. That will cost us lives. So those are for the policymakers, those in the government. Those who I think the police will listen to, because the police are just following orders from the higher ups. Secondly, we wanted to, and we're struggling to do this, and we don't know yet how to do this, to communicate some sort of positive statements to the public, addressing the stigma of drug use and those who are doing low-level drug offense. And we want to know how to, bring that number down from 82% approval of the war on drugs. That's really big challenge for us to, and it's kind of not, it's something that we are, 82% is a really high number, and we're...
Yeah, it is.
Really big wall to climb in terms of doing advocacy communications to the public. Just a few things: that the war on drugs has been a failure. It's been a failure in the U.S. It's been a failure in so many other parts of the world. And that there should be health-based approach in dealing with drug use, and that we shouldn't criminalize people for their health problems. We don't do that for cancer patients. We don't do that for people who has diabetes, who have diabetes. Why are you using that for people who has drug dependence? I mean, even those two things, that drug war is a failure, it has failed so many times over the years, and we should stop doing it. And that number two, we should rethink our ways of addressing drug use. It's not a crime. It's not supposed to be under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system. It should be under the jurisdiction of those who are in the health sector. At least those two things, we want to communicate that out to the public and probably chip in from that 82%. I don't know. Maybe. that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of people. So yeah. This is where...
Sorry. Just last point on that. And thirdly, I forgot, that people who use drugs don't stop having human rights just because they use drugs or they use this kind of things. They don't stop being humans.
Right. I agree.
Will kind of address the stigma that when you're a drug user, you're automatically a criminal, you're automatically a bad person. That's not true. That's not how things should be, and we should address that because it's legitimizing this kind of harsh policies. And I think it's something that's all over the world. These things that are that people who use drugs are essentially bad people, and that the use of drugs is a moral failure. That's becoming something that is causing all the human rights violations against this marginalized community. And that's what's part of the messages that we're trying to put out. Sorry to cut you off.
No. I want to interview you. Nobody wants to hear me ramble on. Here's where I, even during the conference, they started to lose me. I agree that drug treatment should be a health concern, right? So we should, I don't believe in arresting people. I see the point in that it's a failure of the criminal justice system. What we've done is house people. I get all that. I'm with you 100% on that. But where it starts to lose me at is when I hear people kind of equate the difference between, we're not arresting people for having a heart disease or high blood pressure or whatever, because I don't think those are two. I don't think that people who are on drugs, whether it's problematic, as we talked about before, or not, and someone who has heart disease are really the same thing. Now, certainly neither one of those two groups have chosen to have those issues. But at somewhere along the line, people have chosen to pick up a needle or smoke that joint or whatever, or however they get it into their body. And I had this discussion with other people, and I understand that we want to be sensitive to where people are at. I get that. But I don't like that comparison. Having cancer is not the same thing as having a drug addiction.
Oh, I respect it. I think I've gone too far also with the metaphors and, comparing things. But
no, not you, not just you. Other people have said it. I'm not saying you. You did say it. Yes, that's true. But other people did say it. I heard it numerous times at the conference we were at and numerous different panels. Mm-hmm. And that just loses me. Because let me just say, my podcast listeners have heard this before. I actually have heart disease. I had a triple bypass last year. I didn't choose to have heart disease. I mean, I probably could have made better lifestyle choices along the way. To say that that's the same thing as having a drug addiction loses me and loses other people along the way.
Yeah. You're not the first person who told me that. And I think, I'm so sorry about your triple heart bypass, but I think the point is just to treat them in, put them into some sort of medical service. And that's the only thing that we wanted to say, that, treat them as as a health problem. It's not the same thing as cancer, of course, but.
Right. I agree with that. We agree on that point. Let's get them the help and services that they need. Yeah. So during your talk, you talked about, the corruption that has been going on with the police departments, right, or with the police And it's a nationalized police service, right?
Yes.
One police force, essentially, that is nationalized. So there's a corruption that's going on. Since this war started in 2016, now there's corruption going on. There's sexual favors going on in order to get out of prison. Police are beating people, killing people, you know, just going above and beyond. Just talk a little bit about that.
Yes. In the conference, the presentation that I gave was to tell people that the war on drugs is further corrupting the already corrupt police force that we have. So they gave them so much power now that they're on top of the police operation, and they're at the top of the operations. Because the usual, I mean, at least on paper, is that the chief, local chief executives or the mayors, they're supposed to be the ones who are supervising and controlling the police force. They give them orders. Now it's the other way around. It's the police who now heads these agencies, these task force. They are now in power and they call the shots. So what does this resulted into? Aside from all the killings, there have been harassment of people who are subjected to police operations. They beat them up, they lock them up, they detain them for so many hours, even beyond what's 36 hours for grave offense. I mean, beyond the legal time that you can allow detain a person without charge. Aside from that, they have quotas for number of arrests, even for the number of the people that they killed. And that's worrisome because most of the arrests and the killings, they even have some cases of mistaken identities or some people who just give out names that are not really drug users or not really people who are suspected of a drug offense. They just give up names because they have quotas. So it's just the number of people, regardless of who they are. So that has happened. Also, they're incentivized to arrest people or even to kill people. So there have been a lot of police officers who, of course, anonymously have talked about this in the media because they couldn't take it anymore. The orders to kill and for them receiving money at the end of a drug operation for the number of people that they kill. That's harrowing. And it's even causing them, the police officers some of them can't take this enough. They're young, they're very patriotic, they know this neighborhood, they're from this neighborhood. The police officers are not from the middle class sector. They're from the poorer communities, lower income communities. They know these people that were killed by their fellow police officers. And some of them, you know, they needed their job, so they don't want to, you know, most of them don't want to talk about them and you know, identify them. Of course, all of those who spoke to media didn't identify themselves. But this has happened. They couldn't take it anymore. Their conscience are bugging them. And that their order actually is to kill people. That's
hard to believe. That's hard to believe. And they're getting incentives to do it. Get extra money for the amount of killings that they're doing.
Yes, because most police officers, they're $600 USD dollars, 30,000 pesos. That's what the average police officer is making. So I think there have been moves to increase their income.
Right.
I'm not sure at what point in the policy making body is that initiative is already at or at what stage it is, but I think the average, I checked this already, the 30,000 pesos, that's 600 USD. I think that's the average. And to some police officers who have families, they couldn't, you know, they have to also make both ends meet. And so they, you know, kind of accept the fact that they can make money out of this drug operations. Some of them sell the drugs that they seize. So there was a big scandal involving the chief of the Philippine National Police. He resigned already, and there have already been charges against him. Wow. I told about this in the conference because one of the highlights of this war on drugs campaign was that they seized, I think, 600 kilograms of drugs, and then they just reported 38 kilograms, and the rest, they sold it. They profited from it. So they recycle the drugs that they seized. And it's scam that's run by police officers so they can profit from the drug operations. And yes, the sexual favors they ask of women in the households just so they can get their husbands, their parents, their brothers out of a police officer's watch list, or those so that they won't arrest them, or so that they won't kill them. They would offer themselves, or the police would go after and ask for sexual favors, rape them in exchange for the lives of their brothers, fathers, husbands, or partners. And that's been documented. And so, as I've said, power corrupts, and power, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And these police officers, well, except for those who have gained some conscience, or who has conscience, are becoming so bold with the way they conduct these police operations, because they don't get sued anyway. As I've said, 3 years, just one conviction, just those three low-level police officers, low-ranking officers, not even their commanding officers. And I'm not even sure if they're actually in a jail. There's some sort of in a detention for police officers. I don't know about that. So they don't get to be accountable for these abuses. And in the police memorandum circular that they issued in the beginning of the war, which made this war enforced, all those in the on paper, at least, there are limits to the way they exercise their power. There has to be no human rights violations. Once there's discharge of firearm, you get to be investigated. Once there's a human rights violation or a person who died in the operations, regardless of the circumstances, you're going to be investigated administratively. You can get suspended. You can get demoted. And these things, they don't happen. And that's worrisome, because it's also affecting the internal mechanism of the police to keep their officers, away from being corrupted, I guess. So it's also costing the police their professionalism, right. Their, you know, and more especially their, you know, their acceptance with the community, their relationship with the community, because they're supposed to be community police. They have to build relationships with the community. They have to be doing their jobs, being upright about the way they do their jobs, and they shouldn't be abusive. And those things that they do extra from the operations and from the way that they do legitimate police work, that has to be accounted for. That has to be there. They have to pay for it, because it's not in the memorandum. It's not in, that's not the orders. I mean, at least on paper, but there are some orders for them to kill, and there are some money for it. And that's corrupting the whole police force.
You talked about that again, and I just want to make very clear that there has been police officers who've come forward in an anonymous manner and who have documented that they have been told to kill when they're doing these raids and operations. They've been told to kill and given compensation for it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, and you talked about also the relationship between the police and the public. They're supposed to be community officers. Besides this war on drugs, you talked about them. You said specifically that it corrupted an already corrupt police department. So besides this war on drugs, or prior to the war on drugs, how was the relationship, or was there a relationship between the police and the public? Was it better before this war on drugs? And has this war on drugs made it worse, obviously because of the corruption? Let's talk about that a little bit.
It became worse. Well, they're not really very, they're already corrupt police officers. So they're not really stellar in their performance in doing community policing. they also, even for drug offenses, they also arrest drug users, those who are committing low-level offenses. So they've been doing that, not in this intense, systematic way or very violent way, but there are so many.
What other ways were they corrupt besides this war on drugs? Besides the war on drugs, what other ways were they?
Extortion. Extortion is one of the main problems that they have been doing ever since before this war began. Police officers who would, of course, in exchange for an arrest, they would just ask for money and then they won't arrest you. So it's beneficial for the middle class who can pay their way out. So it's a jail-free card. But for those people who can't pay police officers, you're going to go to jail. Things like that. So there's an extortion, there's bribery, you can use money to. There are, as I've said, they're also low income workers. So they needed extra money. And it's their policing is the way for them to conduct raids. There have been so many raids conducted. And then after a raid, they would negotiate with the establishment owner and tell them that, and those who were arrested, and tell them that, okay, so this is your bail anyway for that offense. Why don't you just pay me up and then I won't report you? And that's kind of, it's not, you know, people agree to it, you know, because, you know, if you're going to be arrested, you're going to be detained, you're going to have a criminal record, it will cost you a lot. So it's more practical to pay the police now then go through all the legal process. You're going to hire a lawyer. It will take time. You're going to be detained. You're going to see a judge and everything. Your whole life will be over. And that's kind of the way police conducts policing before, even before the war on drugs. But they don't really, there have been other killings, most especially the activists, but they're more of like,
activists have been killed?
Yes, but more of them are committed by military. So there's a lot of red tagging with activists in the Philippines. And they get to tag you as communist. And therefore, the military can do operations. And sometimes they cost the lives of these activists. But they're more of the military. They're more of the human rights violations of military. There have been cases of some police that are, because most of them all come from the same military academy, even police officers, some of them, those high-ranking officials, they come from the military academy. So they really work closely together. And as I've said, as a way of telling the people in the conference, by way of context, that we were under martial law rule for 30 years ago, and even the southern part of the Philippines is still on martial rule. So there's a blurring of lines between the military and the police. So there have been so many abuses before. The police mostly on the side of extortion and bribery, just so they can get extra money. And the military, those committing human rights violations. Also, the police and some, you know, scandals here now and then against the people, but not in this manner, not in this scale.
Wow, that's really a mouthful. Are you ever fearful of any type of retribution for your activism, for your speaking out? Are you ever scared?
Well, yes. I think there are a lot of activists killed already, detained, political prisoners for speaking out. I think we're at number 38, lawyer gunned down, 39. Yes, yes. Since 2016, that's just 2016. So,
oh my God.
I don't have the numbers of how many are there before 2016. But it's been going on, and we are, but as I've said, we're taking precautions when we do our job, but it's also our job to speak up and be at the forefront of advocating for the rights of people who use drugs and for those who can't speak up, because they have to go underground and they can't be identified and they will be targeted. So it's actually also a recognition of our privilege to come out and say something, because we are lawyers, we are legal officers or officers of the court. But some high-profile cases, some activists who have been very vocal, they have been in some kind of problems, not just the killings, but the some of those in the opposition are charged with sedition, saying things against the government. So there are a lot of harassment going on. But as I've said, we have to do what we have to do. And wow. I think this advocacy in the end, being out there and speaking against all these killings, is also a way for us to be, you know, protected in a way that, you know, you don't, well, they're doing it anyway, but they're not going to target people for being a human rights defender. I mean, that's unconscionable, but it's happening. They have to just legitimize it, call them communists or call them people who use drugs, and then they get to legitimize their... But if you're a human rights advocate, you have to do what you have to do. And yeah, we're hoping for the best. Of course, there are so many security concerns, but we're doing things that we have to do, and also we are mindful of the risk that we're taking.
Do you have security?
I worked in a case before that required security, but it's I worked for that 17-year-old boy killing case. I was the lawyer of the witnesses. What's one? We're a legal team, so I'm the youngest, so I'm not really at the forefront of everything that we did. But at that time, we were issued security details, so because that's a high-profile case. But that's over now, and then we got a conviction, so we don't have one right now. But if there is an active case, we're taking security. I'm not really litigating an active case right now, but if we're gonna do that, we're trying to. We're gonna get security if we needed that, but we are calculating the risk. Most of the cases that we're taking in right now are not very, as we said, most of those who are our clients anyway do not want to file cases against the police. So we're trying other remedies to protect them and not go against the police as of yet. So we're just documenting all the abuses and maybe have them turned over to the UN agencies, ICC, Commission on Human Rights. They have protective measures. So we're doing the best that we can, mindful of the resources.
I definitely give you a lot of credit. You're definitely.
Yes. Security measures are available.
Yeah. In some cases you have to appeal. I want to let you go because I had you for a while here. In some cases you have to appeal to the UN and not just the forces that, by forces, I mean the legislative bodies and all that you mentioned before. You have to go outside the country in order to get some stuff done, right?
Yes. There's an ongoing, I think, report that's, I'm not sure, but our deadline is on next year, I think. Also, the ICC is going to conduct a preliminary investigation of the killings. And we are submitting the documents that we have so far. So,
and that would be the 7,000 killings that have happened since 2016.
For police operations.
Police raids and the police operations that are gone.
Also those 29,000 or, you know, those outside from the 7,000 that were killed and still under investigation, because they shouldn't be, even if they were not committed by the police at the end of the investigation, it shouldn't be happening. It's the negligence of the police officer to let those killings happen. Even if they were committed by drug lords or vigilantes hired by drug lords, even if they're totally not connected with, it's the negligence of the police and the police system that made these homicides possible. So there, it's actually also part of their accountability. So those documentations will kind of link them up to all this human rights violations.
Very good. Thank you so much. It was very informative. I'd like to have you back on sometime, maybe when this report is done that you talked about.
Yes, and, send me an email.
Yeah. I definitely will, and hopefully we won't have the technical difficulties that we had before.
Yeah, but when I'm back in the Philippines, we will have technical difficulties.
Oh, don't say that. Well, I'll get you next time. But you're in New York right now.
Yes.
When do you go back?
Friday.
Okay. Well, enjoy your time in the. Are you just on vacation? Or are you doing any work there, or are you just kind of just
a little work and a little vacation?
Very nice. Very nice. So I would have loved to have done this live, but I got some other priorities I gotta deal with. So, but thank you so much for your time. It was very informative. I would certainly be calling you back. I don't know if your organization takes donations, but where can people reach you at, get more information, you know, about Human Rights Watch or whatever you got going on?
I haven't thought of that. That's our email address. I gave you my email, our email address, streetlawph@gmail.com. And we haven't set up some sort of ways to get donations. I haven't thought of that actually. But yeah, just send me an email and I'll be responding as soon as I can. And thank you for this opportunity to share our story. Thank you so much for doing the work that you do. I'm doing this kind of, because this is very important, telling stories and doing podcasts, doing narratives that's not covered by the mainstream media and that's covered by our state-run press. So this is really, and be able, you know, the space that you gave me to talk about all these things that we're not allowed to talk about back home.
You're very welcome. Thank you for doing it. I really appreciate it. Yes. It's very important to get this information out there, and I want it to be out there. So, and I want you to stay safe too, you know.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So we'll talk to you again. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
I want to thank my special guest, Ms. Christine Mendoza, for being on the podcast. Truly, there was some really interesting stories that she was telling us about the life and times and the problems that are going on with not only the war on drugs, but just law enforcement in general down there in the Philippines. I hope that she and other advocates are staying safe and doing what they can to protect themselves, taking their plight to the UN and doing everything else that needs to be done. So thank you once again to her being on the podcast. If you'd like to reach out to her, her email address is streetlawph@gmail.com. Streetlawph, that's papahotel@gmail.com. Just give them a shout out and see how you can support their cause. So thank you so much for tuning in. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share this episode. Head on over to the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon, patreon.com. You can also support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo. And make sure you follow me on Twitter, CPTL Hunter, Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Facebook, Captain Hunter's Podcast. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, much love and peace.